The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Morten Hansen. Professor Hansen is a management professor at UC Berkeley. He is also a faculty member at Apple University. He is the co-author of the New York Times bestseller Great by Choice and the author of Collaboration. Formerly a professor at Harvard Business School and INSEAD in France, Professor Hansen holds a PhD from Stanford Business School, where he was a Fulbright scholar. His academic work has won several prestigious awards, and he is ranked one of the world's most influential management thinkers by Thinkers 50. He's got a new book. It's called Great at Work, How Top Performers Do Less, Work Better, and Achieve More. Morten Hansen, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Your new book is based on rigorous research done over many years. But like all good books, you start with a compelling story that takes all that sort of data and insight and puts it into a story form that allows us to experience the meaning. And in this case, it was the 1911 race to be the first humans to reach the South Pole. One team was led by Robert Falcon Scott of Britain, and the other team was led by Norway's Roald Amundsen. Tell us what happened and how it applies to your research and findings.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, and I have written about it before with Jim Collins in our book Great by Choice. And some other people, of course, have used that story, although it's not as well known as one would think. I mean, Shackleton is the big name when it comes to polar exploration, right? But this story, I'm using this story for a particular purpose. Because these two individuals, these two leaders of these teams, approach the challenge in such different ways. And one team took a kind of a broad scope view to the challenge. Five different transportation methods, a big team, lots of resources, a big ship, and so on. And it was this kind of like more is better approach, get there. The other one was sort of a do-less approach. One transportation method, a small team, a small budget, a small ship, and so on. So you could almost argue there was an unfair race, right? Because you got this very well-founded project against this smaller project. And in fact, an unfair competition, if you want to put it that way. And that's a fascinating part of this story, because it was the small team, the one with a small budget, the one with a small ship, that ultimately won. And so you've got to ask yourself, why? How is that even possible? And the reason is this concept where I start off with a book, and this comes from our data. We studied 5,000 people trying to understand why some people perform better in the job than others, senior managers, junior people. And the key factor, not the only factor, we have seven in the book, but one key factor was this idea of incredible focus on a few things that matters the most, and then you go all in on that one thing. So Amundsen, who was leading the Norwegian team, he chose to use dogs, and only dogs. But if you're only going to have one method, you better be exceptionally good in that one method. Otherwise, the other guy has five different methods to get there. He had dogs and ponies and skis and whatnot. So you got to be, if you go for one method, you better be exceptional in that one. And that's what he did. So he spent all his effort, all his resources, all his time on perfecting that dog method of transportation to the pole. And that is the one that won. So I call this principle do less, then obsess. And it's a very important principle that we get it, the two kind of the two-punch approach here, which is first you do less, you focus, you choose something, and then you go all in on it. And his story is just a great illustration of that.
Anyone who has worked with me is laughing at this point, because I am so guilty in my career at Second City of having a million different ideas, trying to work on a million different things. But I did, I came around, I learned, probably too late for many people, that it's far better, yes, have a bunch of great ideas, but then pick the one or two that are really good and then drive high quality. And what you find, and this is, I think, a bit of an oxymoron for people at first to think of, is that the constraints are liberating, because there is probably so much more wealth and depth that you can mine out of the task in front of you than you've ever conceived. It's like, you know, you yes and to get a bunch of these great ideas, but then once you got the one idea, there's still a lot of yes anding to do inside that one idea.
Absolutely, and I think that's a great point. And these constraints can be liberating. And I think, you know, good investors in startups, for example, where I am in Silicon Valley, they do that. They start up, you know, a little team, they come with some ideas, and the investor would say, here's a little bit of money. Mm-hmm. Go and test it. And then they go and test it and come back and say, yes, it's working. Okay, here's a little more. Right? But the moment you get, you know, give that startup a lot of money, what are they going to do? They're going to start adding features to their product. They're going to add markets to the product. They're going to buy some fancy furniture. You know, they're going to hire more people than they really need. And then it's getting bloated and slow. And so it's an interesting concept. It is almost a paradox that if you have less, you can actually innovate more and you can do more things.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm guilty as charged here, you know, as well. I like to say yes to many things.
Yeah.
Right? It's like there are many ideas and there are many things you can pursue and there are many interesting things you can do. But it comes back to hurt you because you can't be great in many things.
Right. And I want to talk about a thing that you talk about in the terms of the complexity trap. I think this is really important to understand, because my observations is that this is what gums up the works a lot. And you quote Nobel winner Herbert Simon saying, a quote, a wealth of information creates a poverty of attention. So how does complexity factor into this?
Yeah, so I think what's happening in a lot of companies is that we pile on more work, more initiatives, more collaboration, more meetings, more task forces, more metrics, more objectives, you name it. And the problem is that it creates complexity. We need to coordinate among these initiatives. We need to trade off among five different metrics. And before you know it, you're just caught up in this coordination activity and all these things you have to keep track on. And the problem, of course, is that complexity, it slows you down. It creates constraints. There are too many people you need to check in with. And your work is going to be slow, it's not going to be the quality, and you're spending your time in coordination. And that is a thing that is plaguing so many workplaces today.
You actually have a great quote. You say, being busy is not an accomplishment.
Yeah, you know, that is amazing, right? So we add on all these things, and then we have all these metrics, and we think that this is, you know, producing results.
Mm-hmm.
But think about it. Going to meetings, traveling on business, racking up freaking flyer miles, calling customers, these are not accomplishments in and of themselves. There are volumes of activity. So we have this perverse nature of tracking volume metrics that are not necessarily what I call value metrics, that they are driving results.
Mm-hmm.
Give an example from the book. We came across this guy who was managing in a logistics function in a warehouse where they were shipping out industrial products to their corporate customers. Now, he had one metric, and that was the number of shipments leaving his dock on time. And it was 99%, which is pretty impressive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then he went and surveyed the customers, the corporate customers, and they complained that only 65% of the shipments arrived when they needed them. But they weren't tracking that to begin with, right? So one is 99% is just, you know, I'm tracking one metric here. It's an internal metric geared to what we do, our schedule. But the customers have a different metric. That's a value metric. Are you helping your customer get the products when they need it? In this case, not.
It's so funny, right? Because we talk about this in our work about the empathy and that so often people are measuring empathy at the speaker's mouth rather than the listener's ear. So like you're just doing it wrong. It doesn't matter how you feel about it. It's you know, what's the person on the receiving end? And this is a similar sort of dichotomy of like you're just looking at it the wrong way.
Exactly. That's a great point. It's exactly the same. So you start looking. If we think about any work, has a beneficiary. There's somebody who's supposed to be benefiting from the output of your work. It could be a customer, obviously, but it could also be somebody internally, another department, a colleague, or whatever it is. And so then you have to measure the value of your work from the point of view of that beneficiary. Right? It's the same idea. It's not from your point of view. It's from their point of view.
Yeah.
And are you meeting, are you adding value to them is the metric.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And the guy sitting there in that warehouse shipping out the products, it was his schedule.
And I'm okay. So then you leap to this idea. Let's say we're there. We've got the idea. We know what we want to focus on. So what does obsession in the workplace look like? I think you have some great stories around this with individuals that you profile.
Yeah. So if you go back to the South Pole race, right? So if you're going to do dogs, you need to obsess over dogs. So what did he do? Well, first of all, he did research to figure out what are the very best dogs to take to the South Pole. And it wasn't what people were using. He found Greenland dogs. People were not using Greenland dogs back then.
Hmm.
He goes to Greenland, and he then finds somebody who can help him get the very best Greenland dogs. And then he pays a premium for those dogs because he must have the best Greenland dogs. And then he needs dog drivers. And he goes and finds the best dog drivers, but they don't want to sign on. So he keeps on exciting them and paying them more salary. And he keeps on harassing them until he gets the very best dog drivers. Right? So we flip that to kind of the modern day work. So there's this wonderful story I put in the book about, it's based on a movie actually called Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic documentary of arguably the best sushi chef in the world. He has a small, unassuming restaurant in the subway in Tokyo with a 12 counter places, and the toilet is out in the hallway. I mean, not exactly a fancy restaurant.
No.
But he serves only 20 pieces of sushi. You can't get an appetizer, tempura, whatever. You get 20 pieces of sushi that is pre-selected. But each one is an incredible perfection. For example, he has figured out that the octopus sushi, the octopus meat, if he hand massage that for 30 minutes, it gets really tender. And then he figured out if you hand massage it for 50 minutes, that's the optimal hand massage. So somebody in this restaurant is hand massaging the octopus meat for 50 minutes.
Oh my God.
To make sure that is going to be the best ever. But that is an extreme. Right? We can't be around doing that in everyday work. But what it really means is fanatic attention to detail. It means going the extra mile. It means trying to produce that exceptional quality and be dissatisfied. It means not being on autopilot. So if you're a teacher and you're given that class 20 times before, it means the night before your class, you go through your lecture notes one more time to make sure they're absolutely great and you update them. And then you go back in, even if you could have done it on autopilot. Right? These small things matter a great deal if you want to obsess to excel.
And this is a good point for me to once again ask another expert in this field about multitasking, the thing that we're all asked to do in our business. What does the research tell us about multitasking?
It's very simple. Research tells us that it does not work.
Yep.
Meaning that if you do two complicated tasks at the same time, you're not going to do those two tasks as well as if you did them in sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can do mundane tasks. I mean, you can walk and chew gum at the same time, so to speak. But if but in the workplace, we sit in meetings and we listen. We think we listen to the debate in the meeting, and we're checking our phone or our emails. Okay? That doesn't work. You are not really listening to that debate. And there's a lot of good academic research on this. One I like is a fantastic academic study from Italian judges in Italy. And it's almost like a random experiment because they were randomly assigned all these cases, parole case decisions they had to make. And then the question is, and they have a huge caseload. So some judges sort of have a lot of these cases going on at the same time. others sort of do them in sequence. And it turns out the ones who do them in sequence are actually completing them faster and better than the ones who are juggling too many cases.
Mm.
And when we start looking at it, it makes sense, because multitasking, either in the second or in the minute or in the day, there is always switching costs. You have to leave one task to get another. Even in if you're using a phone or listening to a meeting, you're sitting and looking at your phone, and you, in a nanosecond you have to switch on to the meeting, and you're losing attention all the time. So it doesn't work. You know, I tell my students at Berkeley, you cannot multitask in my class. And if I see you do it in my class, you will automatically get a B in class participation.
Hmm.
And they, you know, don't like it.
Yeah.
And they think I'm kind of old-fashioned because they think it works.
But it
doesn't.
Even
though I showed them the research.
Yeah. And you talk about this idea of a learning loop. And I guess that's a concept I always think about as practice. This idea of variation and trying new ideas is, you say, essential to learning. And I think about some of the study, I think Adam Grant talks about this, where, you know, a little bit of procrastination is good. That can help feed your very hard work that you have to do. So what is it about sort of like variation? How's that play into learning?
Yeah, it's really important, because if you want to learn and improve, you have to experiment with new things. It could be a small thing. So if you're in sales, it could be that you have not perfected your sales pitch, but you go to a new customer or another customer and you kind of tweak it a bit to try it out.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to be prepared that that's going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be as good as the one you had. And sometimes, of course, if you do that, you will find one that's maybe even better. And that's how you progress. Now, you have to experiment smart, which is you don't go to your best and most important customer and try to complete a new sales pitch for a new product, right? You do it on a more smaller customer where the stakes are less high. But this is a very important. We need to introduce that variation, that experimentation and a bit of risk-taking to progress at work. And oftentimes, we're driven to the opposite.
Right.
So think about total quality management. It's about driving out variance. It's about getting rid of experimentation and things that are just a variation from the best performance. And we reach an optimal point, and we're afraid of experimenting because we're afraid of going down in performance, right? We might lose a few sales if we're trying out new sales pitches. So we have to be prepared for that in order to get to the next level.
We just had Ori Brofman on the podcast, who said no one ever gets fired for not innovating.
That's right. Exactly.
And this whole, you know, and we talk about this a lot at Second City, because we create our art through an improvised process that we test out material in front of the audience. And it's very designed. So, like, it's you know, we have two acts of scripted content. And this third act, which is late at night, it's free. People have been drinking. That's where we're going to try out the stuff. We often change our clothes so that they're a little more casual. And that's sort of our failure module. That's our place to play with stuff. And
right.
Gradually we introduce new material into the show. And we don't overwhelm it with new material, because we recognize the importance of failure, but we also recognize that you can't just fail. You have to have coordinated risk.
Absolutely. And this is the time. I mean, I learned it the hard way. I was running my course at Berkeley, and one year I decided to change everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like every case, every session, with new material. And I was kind of busy at the time, so I didn't have the time that I could spend on the material. In other words, I wasn't obsessing, so I was breaking that rule too.
Yeah.
And then I put on this brand new course, right? And it wasn't good.
Mm.
And I went back and said to myself, how could I have done this?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, you could start experimenting, you're putting in new things, and when you do, you got obsessed to make it great. A great example from the book, I met this high school principal out of Detroit, Greg Green, who is the principal of Clintondale High School, and their high school was failing. The students were failing in their classes, and it was looking really bad. And he hit upon this idea of the flipped classroom, which is, you know, you do homework at school and you watch video lectures at home, right? The flipping, the two,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, he wanted to do that. He thought that could work at his school. But the way he did it was really smart. Instead of announcing, you know, everybody, we're flipping now,
right?
Which would be incredibly risky. He started off with one class, and he had social science, and they sort of said, okay, you guys in this class do the flip model, and you guys do the normal model, and then see how it works.
Hmm.
And it turned out it was much better. Then he did one for math and one for English. And he spent a year experimenting on this stuff. And then when it worked, he said, now we have enough proof we have done what, you know, was needed, and then he kind of rolled it out. And that's a smart way to experiment.
It's a great story, and if I remember this right from the book, he discovered it because he coached baseball and wanted to. He found these videos on YouTube which explained how each position is to be played, and sent those to his players. Just these sort of individual lectures, and it was really, really effective.
Yes, exactly. I mean, he started out. He was coaching the baseball team, and they had this problem that they went to the practice, and they were all watching him, and they weren't really practicing.
Right.
So he figured, okay, if they watch these video clips at home, and he made a number of them himself. And then, you know, they were much better. So he kind of flipped the idea of baseball practice. And then, you know, he thought later, hey, wait a minute, maybe this could work in my school too. And that's a great story, because the source of creativity and new ideas can come from very different fields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think also digging into this idea of practice and rehearsal. So when you think about this in the world, very high functioning groups of people who have to work together, they practice and rehearse a lot. So whether it's a theater company, a symphony orchestra, dancers, baseball players, golfers, whomever, because a lot of money's on the stake at stake, and we want to be the highest quality possible. Why then in business, where the money is probably just as big, if not more, is there literally not the same level of practice or rehearsal?
Yeah, so I was very surprised by that, because the model you're referring to is the deliberate practice model.
Yep.
That Anders Ericsson, a professor at Florida State, you know, has really pioneered. And you really wonder, right, because the rate of improvement is so much higher. So we were looking at that in our study. And what I found, though, is this. People are too busy to practice at work.
Hmm.
And so it's extremely difficult. So that's why I call, instead of calling it deliberate practice, I call this model in this chapter the learning loop.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is the idea that you can practice while you're working. So, and you can just insert a little bit of practice every day that kind of adds up. So if you're a manager, you run meetings, you're overworked. I mean, that's one thing that's going on today. People are just overworked. They have so much to do.
Yep.
But let's say you want to improve the way you run meetings. Now, you might then sit down and say, okay, what are the elements I can do better in my meeting? Well, for example, I want to have a great discussion, but it's not really great right now. So I need to ask better questions when I'm running these meetings, because good questions generate better debate. Okay, now I'm going to practice asking better questions.
Yeah.
So before I have a meeting, I might sit down and say, okay, here are the three questions I think are good. I go to the meeting, I use those questions, I see if I get better debate, I can measure that myself, or I can ask my colleagues for feedback. How was the debate in this meeting today? Then I get some feedback. Maybe it didn't work. Maybe the question was still bad. Then I modify my behavior, and now I just completed a loop. And I keep on doing this. And what we found is that if you do it that way, if you break it down to these small chunks, then you can actually practice an experiment while working and getting into this loop of performance improvement. So you don't have to spend, you know, 4 hours practicing. Now, having said that, you know, of course, if you're doing something extremely important, like a massive presentation, you better set aside more time to rehearse.
Right. Our meetings are too long. If you have focus, the amount of work you can get done in 20 minutes is kind of remarkable. And again, speaking to the constraints, I wonder if, too, we just got to stop setting these 60-minute meetings and see if we can get done in 15.
You know, it's terrible. I was actually just signing up for Google Calendar a few months ago. I haven't used it.
Uh-huh.
You know what the default was?
What?
With an hour.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you click on it, and it automatically pops up an hour.
It's I changed mine to half hour. I literally did that because I was like, and it was a nudge, right, for myself. Like, you the tendency in my entire career at Second City, and I've worked there for nearly 30 years, was always the hour-long meeting. And it wasn't until I've been reading studies and everything, now I start with a 30-minute meeting, and I try to actually make it 15 if I can.
Meetings are too long and they're too ineffective. So in our study, you know, people are complaining about meetings. I was citing in the book a study on Microsoft that 69% of people think the meetings are unproductive. And the worst thing is that if you have a bad meeting, you know, what's the consequence of a bad meeting? It's a follow-up meeting to continue the discussion that you didn't resolve in the first one.
Yeah.
So we're just getting bad meetings lead to more bad meetings, right?
Yep.
You've got to fix it. And the way to fix it is that meetings should only be for one thing. And that is a debate. If you have a status update, put it in an email. I mean, I love that mug that is out there. You know, I survived another meeting that should have been an email. I mean, you got to use meetings. You bring in people together. Have a discussion about something important.
Yep.
Don't sit there and update of what's happened in the office the last week.
Right, the status report, the status update. Yeah, it's the worst. Okay, so we're coming close to the end, and I am going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we do that, I picked like three things from the book that I'm also just interested in getting your sort of quick take on. One is you say we've been thinking about passion in our careers all wrong. So why? What are we thinking wrong about? It should be good to be passionate about your work, right?
Yes, but we let that direct what we're doing, and that's the wrong part, because there's another question that we found is more important, and that is, what's your purpose? That is, do what contributes. What are you contributing to others? Passion is about the world gives you, and purpose is about what you give the world. If you have a great purpose, great value creation, you will have more success, you will have more longevity, and of course, top performers try to match that with their passion. It's the matching of the passion and the purpose that gives the best performance. But I think they've been overdone this idea of passion.
Yeah, so there's a duality at play there.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, and you also quote the Stanford Business School professor, Jeffrey Pfeffer, with, quote, putting yourself in the other's place is one of the best ways to advance your own agenda. How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, that is about, we live in a world where you have to influence and excite others. Mm-hmm. I call it being a forceful champion. Because you can't just order people around. You're going to work with people over whom you have no formal authority. So you get to inspire them and persuade them. And then you have to understand that many of those are going to be neutral or opposed or have other agendas than yours. And for you to really understand how you can get their support, you've got to understand their concerns, their initiatives. And that means putting yourself in their shoes. And you've got to start there. And that's so important, and we so often forget that. And that is what Jeff Pfeffer is reminding us. That we must do.
Yeah, and to note too, it's not just enough to be listening. You know, people are can be complex, and there's many sides to them, and we tend to do the shortcuts, right? We think, oh, you must think this way, or you must think that way, without really getting to know where that person stands and who that person is, and understanding too what the behavioral science shows us, which is how gratifying it is to be understood,
right.
and the ability that the bonds that you can strike with someone if you really attempt to understand them.
Exactly, yeah, and it's a bit of hard work, but if you start there, as opposed to starting what you think, because that's what we do automatically,
yep.
You can really progress in the sense of getting their support.
Okay, the other one was this quote, the goal of collaboration is not collaboration.
Yes, many, many companies, they collaborate for the sake of collaborating, because that's the norm.
Yeah.
I think that the more is better,
yeah.
Right? And it isn't. So we're getting a lot of unproductive collaboration. We say yes to too many things on those, because if you dare saying, you know, no to those or saying maybe we should do something else, then you're not seen as a team player. So we need to, I call it disciplined collaboration. We need to discipline collaboration.
Right.
Do a few good ones and do them really well.
It's interesting. I was explaining this to someone on the phone today who was writing an article on our work, and they understood improv. And so they got how we see collaboration and how the whole process is very collaborative. And I said, to a point, because what you forget is at Second City in particular, we use improvisation in our process, but we carry it to being scripted content. So the end result is this two-act review that is highly scripted. And that means the collaboration ends at a certain point and shifts. It doesn't mean that we still don't have the spirit of collaboration, which is a kind of openness to experience, but we know when we need to refine to quality, that's when the no's come out. And what we find is because we have been so collaborative up to that point, people don't take the no's personally.
Right. I mean, I think that's a great, great point. I mean, there's a role, there's a time for collaboration, and there's time for not doing it. And getting that right is really important, as opposed to just saying it's a good thing always.
Yeah, and it's different at different points in your business, at different times. You know, there's no one way and time you should collaborate. So that's important to know. Okay, so I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. This is how we end the podcast. We asked our guest if they've had a point in their life when they had a situation which they normally would just say no to, but in fact they said yes and. You know, they not just a yes, but they like went with it. And what happened? Do you have one of those for us?
Yeah, I do. 5 years ago, one of my former colleagues started Apple University, which is the leadership development arm of Apple. And he started talking about me joining that and wanted me to join that. And it's an incredible setup, an incredible place. But, you know, I have another job, which is I'm a professor at Berkeley.
Yeah, that's busy.
So, you know, the normal reaction would be say, no, I have to turn it down, sorry, right? But then we started thinking about it, and I did the yes and, which is, yes, sounds great, and can I do it part-time?
Mm-hmm.
And I will then get rid of some of my other outside engagements and focus on that. And then we had a conversation around that, and we started figuring out a way that I could do that while also being professor at UC Berkeley. And to this day, I'm doing both.
Hmm.
And I've been extremely rewarding. It's fantastic to be part of Apple. And I get to be a professor and do the books and being out, you know, doing things that I love doing. And I think it is a great, for me personally, a great yes and story. Because the knee-jerk reaction was no.
Right.
And of course then you have to choose. Right? But now sometimes in life you don't have to.
Yeah.
If you can come up with a creative kind of resolution to it.
Yep. The book is called Great at Work. It's really, really good. Great storytelling and real research that draws on. So I recommend everyone get it. Morten Hansen, thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.